Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. This is a recording from the monthly Oldie Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club. To book a ticket, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk/lunches.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Our last speaker is one of our greatest novelists, Sebastian Faulks, who read his books, Birdsong and Charlotte Gray, and he's now written his memoir, Fires Which Burn Brightly, A Life in Progress. Ladies and gentlemen, Sebastian Faulks.
Thanks, Harry. How nice it is to be here and to be the youngest person in the room. Whoa. That's a boast, actually. I'm sure it's not true either, because my wife is here. She's much younger. But it's lovely to be in the National Liberal Club. I was last here, actually, for the launch of Robert Harris's book about Venetia, who is a relative of Anna's. But, you know, I don't have posh relations like Anna, and I haven't done interesting things and been to exotic places like Sarah. So why on earth would I write a memoir when I spent my whole life sitting on my backside making things up? Well, the truth is that between writing novels, you have periods where you're hoping that some wonderful idea is going to come and find you and give you a beautiful new work of art to occupy you for 2 or 3 years. But meanwhile, your fingers are itching to do something. If you're a writer, you have to write. So about 25 years ago, I first scribbled down a bit about my childhood, thinking I might forget about it if I didn't get it down then. And so on and so forth. And over the years, I realized I put together quite a few bits and pieces. And I worked for a long time as a journalist on newspapers, so I had a vague idea of discipline and word length and so on, but I never thought these things would make a book. I didn't really want to write a memoir because, for a start, it seems so self-important. You know, what have I done? You know, I haven't been to the moon or run a country or made millions in a bank or whatever things people do. And the other reason I didn't want to write a memoir was that many of them are just not that interesting. There's always that paragraph early on which begins, "My maternal grandfather, on the other hand." I was born in 1953, which is why I'm not actually the youngest person in this room, and brought up near Newbury in Berkshire in the post-war world. It seems rationing was just ending. My parents were lovely, but we didn't have any money, but nor did anyone else. So that was fine. And then I went to boarding school, which is about which there's quite a lot in this book. First to a little school called Elstree, which, this was in 1961, but it could have been 1861, really. It was Latin, it was Greek, it was maths, it was rugby. And after I got over the trauma of being separated from home, I did get on quite well there and quite enjoyed it. Then went to a terrible school called Wellington College. Less said about that, the better. And then I arrived in Paris. Now, that was fun. So I'm 17, I've left school, and I arrive in a little room in a flat in the 17th arrondissement in Paris. Now, my idea of Paris was that I'd meet lots of girls, have lots of wild love affairs, late-night parties, dinners by the Seine, and so on. In fact, I didn't really meet anyone. I was very, very lonely. So I arrived home 3 months later, having read the whole of the Cambridge syllabus in advance, and tragically fluent in French. But so I suppose my dad thought that was pretty good value, really. I went to Cambridge. This, by the way, this isn't really a memoir. It's not told in this chronological way, but I'm just trying to speed us through. I know lots of you are bursting to go home or bursting to go to the loo and weren't quite sure whether to go or not, whether it might seem disrespectful, and so on. Anyway, in Cambridge, first day I met a wonderful guy called Ian Black, who was my great friend and roommate, and has written a brilliant book about the Middle East, which some of you may have come across, called Enemies and Neighbours, The History of Israel and Palestine. And Ian and I were on the University Challenge team in the beginning of our second year. I was only 19. I didn't know anything about anything, let alone what they know nowadays. Bloody hell, it was so knowledgeable, it's unbelievable. We drove up to Manchester to record the programme, and there was, we each asked each other what our speciality was, and Ian said, my speciality is history and politics, and then there's a guy called John Cole who said, I do the ancient world, and there was a boy called Laurie Kirby, and we said, what's your speciality? He said, oh, I'm a scientist. And then there was a bit of a pause, and people said, so, Sebastian, what about you? And I said, well, I've been playing a lot of golf recently. There was a terrible silence descended in the car. Anyway, we arrive in Manchester. On the advice of the producer, we go out to the pub beforehand, where I have about 6 pints. And you can smoke in those days. You can smoke on television. So I arrive on television, I'm pretty... I've had 6 pints, chain smoking, barely visible behind the smoke. First question, what was the military rank of the officer who gave his name to the standard score in golf before the arrival of the par? Bzzz, Emmanuel Foakes. Colonel, correct. So, I've been drinking steadily ever since. This was particularly helpful to me when I arrived in Fleet Street to be a journalist. I worked, as did Harry, on a very friendly gossip column on the Daily Telegraph called the Peterborough column. And I was interviewed in Elvino, of course, by the editor of the column. And he asked me a few questions about myself, and I gave him a few answers, mostly about the fact that my grandfather had worked for the Daily Telegraph and had, in fact, died in its service as a war reporter in 1945, going across the Rhine with American troops. So eventually I said to Michael Hogg, you know, can you tell me what an average day is like? And he said, we get in about 10, read the papers, 11:15 I go to the Cheshire Cheese, have a couple of pints, come back, read the papers, 1 o'clock I go out to lunch, come back about 3:30, and round about 5 o'clock we try and put some sort of column together. Other days we just drink. So I thought that sounded pretty much up my street. There's a chapter in this book about drink and about wine, which I'm very keen on, and this involved a lot of going to France and a lot of heavy research. And research, I was very interested by what Sarah was saying about Jan Morris and finding those letters. You have to be lucky with research. And there's a long chapter in this book called Do You Do Much Research? Which is the question I most often ask at literary festivals. So I thought I'd give the definitive once and for all answer. And the answer is briefly, probably not as much as you'd think. But you do get lucky a bit. And we went to live in France for a bit when I was writing Charlotte Gray. We had two very small children at that time. One on the way, and my wife went for a walk in the woods with our little boy, and she came across a coin which she pulled out from under a tree, and the coin was dated 1941, which was exactly the period I was writing about, which is the period of the Vichy government under the German occupation. So instead of saying République Française on the coin, it said État Français, Famille, Travail, Patrie. So this was a sort of semi-fascistic sub-German state at that point. So I kept that, I glued it, in fact, to the side of my typewriter, which is what I was using in those days. I also discovered in doing research into Special Operations Executive, SOE, for which Charlotte works, that their code name for the moon, it was very important to have a full moon when you were dropping agents into occupied France, their code name for the moon was Charlotte. And I thought, oh, this is a great omen. I'm quite superstitious, and you have to be lucky with all these things. And the next book I wrote on Green Dolphin Street, which is set in America during the Kennedy-Nixon election. At one point, my main characters are in 1959, 1960, 61 now, that period. They go out of Washington, and they go for a weekend on Chesapeake Bay, And I did this journey myself in a car, and you come to a bridge, and it's a toll bridge. So I discovered how much the toll would have been in 1959, and it was $1.50. So I rather proudly put that exact number into the book with a bit of grumbling about how expensive it was. Both my British and American publishers said, there's no way it could have been that much money. That's ridiculous. We can't print this. So I showed them the printout from the Port Authority, and I showed them all the research, and they said, no, you just can't get away with that. So in the book, I think I brought it down to 50 cents. So it's inaccurate. But what this shows you is that fiction has to be believable. It doesn't have to be accurate. So between fact and fiction, one of them has to be believable. Of course, the internet has made a massive, massive difference to research. When I was researching birdsong, I used to go to the Imperial War Museum and sit beneath their very dim lights for hours on end, ordering up from literally a card index, little cards saying, collection of documents, blogs, BJ, Rifleman, Lancashire Regiment, some details of regimental baths, rats, posting to loose, whatever it was. And you would just pick out these things at random. You didn't know what was any of them were going to contain. And these big brown folders were then brought up from the basement, and you'd open the piece of ribbon and the documents would tumble out onto the desk. And sometimes you got lucky and sometimes you didn't. It was a very, very laborious process, which partly destroyed my eyesight, I think. But when I was researching a later book called Where My Heart Used to Beat, part of which takes place in Italy near Naples during the Second World War, I wanted to calculate whether it was possible for my main character to spend a rather romantic evening and indeed night in a hotel in a place called Pozzuoli with his Italian girlfriend and still be back in time at battalion headquarters the next day. So I got out my Oxford Mathematical Instruments tin and my dividers, and I started doing calculations using a ruler, and I thought, hang on. So I asked Google Maps. It said, the drive will take 24 minutes in current conditions. So all this is pretty helpful, really. And I'm not quite sure if I've completely lost track of time. There's another chapter in the book, or essay really, about America, a country which has meant a lot to me. I've been there many, many times and written about it, and you go on these very, very long tours from coast to coast where every morning you have to get up at 6 o'clock for an 8 o'clock flight. And if it's Tuesday, it's Chicago. If it's Wednesday, it's San Francisco. If it's Friday, it's somewhere else. It's absolutely, utterly exhausting. But the America I knew was a wonderful place, really. Incredibly hospitable, generous, and particularly if you're spending most of your time on either coast, full of very literary, intelligent people. And this was summed up for me, actually, in a story by Scott Fitzgerald. At the end of it, it's called The Swimmers, and the main character is disillusioned. This is in 1929, by American greed and profiteering, and he emigrates to Europe. He looks back from the deck of his ship at the receding continent, and he says, the best of America was the best of the world. It was the graves at Shiloh and the tired, drawn, nervous faces of its great men, and the country boys dying in the Argonne for a phrase that was empty before their bodies withered. It was a willingness of the heart. And that's the America that I think we all want to sort of keep going. Okay, 1 minute, that's fine. I've just got about 1 minute left, actually. My publisher would kill me if in my last 1 minute I didn't mention the fact that I have a new novel coming out. It's coming out in September. It's called Farewell to Eden, and it's set in post-war Britain and somewhat also in Palestine in 1946-47, the last days of the British Mandate. And I'm just going to end with a quotation from a poem by John Updike, great American novelist whom I was lucky enough to interview in Boston. And as he was dying, he wrote, excuse me, he wrote in his hospital bed, "Be with me, words, a little longer. You have given me my quick claim in the sun, sealed shut my adolescent wound, made light of grown-up troubles, turned to my advantage what in most lives would be pure deficit, and formed of those I loved more solid ghosts." And that's why one is a writer. Thank you.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter "old trial" as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter "old trial".